From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
Thanks so much for checking out another edition of the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart. This is the show. It's news, information, and everything you ever wanted to know about paternity tests.
I've actually got some very specific questions about that later in the show. Glad to hear we're finally covering something relevant to my life. I'm Luke Burbank. This is the Bryant Park Project. Thank you so much for joining us. We got a lot of stuff going on today. We're going to talk to a band, The Hold Steady. We saw them in concert last night out in Brooklyn, and we have a backstage interview we're going to play for you.
And we're also going to delve into the subject of kidults. Kidults. You can go Google it. It's grown-up people who still behave and act like they're little ones or teenage ones. We'll figure out why.
We're also going to have our now famous Make Me Care session. We'll talk about the week in Iraq. We'll also have lots of news from Matt Martinez right now, though. It's time for our top story today.
The United States is falling down, or at least some major seams are ripping. Just last night, two more bodies were pulled from the Mississippi River, a victim of that Minnesota bridge collapse. New York City officials announced this week, look, it could be months before they know what caused that steam explosion in Midtown. Mm-hmm. And right now, they're really just trying to keep the subways, the trains running on time.
Yeah.
The subway system on Wednesday, this is a subway system in New York City, which carries 4 million people a day, had to shut down because there was a whole bunch of rain. So,
isn't it underground? I mean, I haven't ridden every mile of track, but it seems like it would be okay being that it's subterranean.
I guess the water gets there first. But you think about it. You've got the Loop in Chicago. You've got the Big Dig. We all know what happened to New Orleans exactly 2 years ago this month.
Yeah.
Yesterday, President Bush, he actually addressed the issue of the nation's infrastructure.
The American people need to know that we're working hard to find out why the bridge did what it did so that we can assure people that the bridges over which they'll be traveling will be safe. That's step one.
They also asked the president during this press conference how he thinks we should pay for any necessary bridge repairs.
Would you be willing to go along with an increase in gasoline taxes of 5 cents a gallon or more?
First of all, my suggestion would be that they revisit the process by which they spend gasoline money in the first place. So before we raise taxes, which could affect economic growth, I would strongly urge the Congress to examine how they set priorities. And if bridges are a priority, let's make sure we set that priority first and foremost before we raise taxes.
So he was not willing to promise that he was going to raise taxes to try to actually...
Pretty clear about that.
Actually, though, the governor of Minnesota, this guy named, he's a Republican too, his name's Tim Pawlenty, and he has been a very staunch kind of opposer of tax increases of any kind. Of course, now he's come out and said that he favors a gas tax hike to help cover the cost of the bridge repairs. You know, some people are saying, hey, you know, Pawlenty, what happened to the Tim Pawlenty we knew before the bridge disaster? Well, you know, all politics is local, right? Which is what I think Tip O'Neill said. And so he now says, Pawlenty says, quote, I'm probably the biggest proponent against taxes, but we have an extraordinary crisis situation.
It's really scary to think how much of the basic framework of the country might be shaky. This recent op-ed in Popular Mechanics magazine said, quote, the fact is that Americans have been squandering the infrastructure legacy bequeathed to us by earlier generations. Like the spoiled offspring of well-off parents, we behave as though we have no idea what is required to sustain the quality of our daily lives.
Yeah,
ouch.
Yeah, we're like the Paris Hiltons of steam pipes or
you
something.
You just got to work that in every show somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, in just a minute, we're going to talk to about this issue in more depth with Jerry Balanson, the deputy editor of Popular Mechanics.
First, though, let's get you caught up on all the top stories, some Paris Hilton related, some not. With Matt Martinez.
Put a quarter in the jar.
Yeah, thanks, Luke. Thanks, Allison. Here are some of the stories we're following this morning. It was silence on the mic in Utah early this morning. A microphone was lowered into the Utah mine where six coal miners are believed to be trapped. The mic picked up no noise, but an air sample indicated there was enough oxygen to breathe in the chamber, and rescuers vowed to keep digging. Meanwhile, the governors of Mississippi and Kansas are joining in on the rescue effort. They've helped to arrange an Air Force C-17 cargo jet to fly sophisticated camera equipment that will be lowered down into the mine. Wall Street skidded even further today as investors remained jittery and anxious over tight credit conditions. The Dow dropped 133 points in the opening minutes of trading. Yesterday, U.S. stocks suffered their second worst decline of the year when the Dow Jones lost 387 points. The Federal Reserve announced this morning that it will provide liquidity to help bolster U.S. financial markets. What the market fears mean for you later on in the show. NASA engineers are trying to figure out whether foam insulation that broke off the fuel tank during liftoff has damaged the space shuttle Endeavour. The shuttle is expected to come within 600 feet of the International Space Station before docking and do a giant backflip so the station crew members can zoom in for pictures of the damaged part of the shuttle. The Discovery Channel has dropped its sponsorship of the American-based cycling team. The team wasn't able to find another sponsor, so it will disband at the end of this season. Team manager Johan Brunel said the drug scandals surrounding the sport are so bad that nobody wants to be involved with it. Most of the Democratic presidential candidates were in Los Angeles last night for the first forum on gay rights to be televised live. It was carried on the Logo cable channel that features programming catering to a gay audience. Democratic candidates Christopher Dodd and Joseph Biden did not appear at the forum, citing scheduling conflicts. And Republicans in South Carolina have set their primary date for January 19th. That has set off something of a chain reaction among other states like New Hampshire and Iowa, who are jockeying to retain their first-in-the-nation primary and caucus. I'm Matt Martinez. The news is always online at npr.org. Back to you, Luke and Allison.
Thank you, Matthew.
You're welcome.
As Allison was saying just a few minutes ago, the president spent a part of his press conference yesterday talking about infrastructure, which is not a topic you would think would be getting national attention and like the president of the United States would be dedicating time to.
Especially when he's on his way to vacation, considering Iraq and all that's going on. But obviously the past couple of weeks, it's all anybody's really talking about,
usually. Yeah, and he said in the press conference that, you know, the nation's – we're working hard and that the nation's infrastructure is fine, although it would seem that these recent events like the bridge collapse in Minnesota and here in New York, this steam pipe exploded – and yesterday the subways weren't working, or 2 days ago the subways weren't working. So it seems like the president's saying one thing, but at least anecdotally, if you're living in New York anyway or Minnesota, it feels like – it just feels like the nation's infrastructure might be like my 86 Hyundai.
Everything didn't change the oil.
It had like 130,000 miles on it, and then just everything started to go at once. You know,
keep
it wasn't
the tire pressure up.
Just... Yeah, exactly. So we thought we'd actually talk to somebody who knows a lot about this stuff. We've got Jerry Balinson here. He's deputy editor of Popular Mechanics magazine. They had an op-ed piece after the bridge collapse kind of talking about the nation's infrastructure. Are all of these things that we just mentioned a coincidence, or have we really been sort of letting it go in terms of keeping up on infrastructure?
Well, actually, unfortunately, it's not a coincidence. I mean, we've had the steam tunnel explosion like you were talking about, the Minneapolis bridge collapse, and a lot of other things in the last few months. I mean, there was a we came very close to having a major dam collapse in Tennessee that nobody really heard about. And, of course, we're coming up on the two-year anniversary of Katrina, which is August 29th. And that was, you know, the biggest infrastructure failure in the country's history. So, no, things are aging, and they haven't been maintained well. And so it's not just a coincidence.
Is it just because infrastructure is not a sexy topic? Nobody wants to raise money to build something that no one even sees or fix up something no one sees?
That is definitely part of it. But it also has to do with the fact that there was just a lot of great stuff built in the mid-20th century. And if you look at the year 1960, how many 50-year-old highways were there? Well, there were none. How many 50-year-old bridges were there? Not very many. So we're at the stage now where we have a country filled with great infrastructure, but we're not really maintaining it. We're not keeping it up. And a lot of the attention is on other things. I mean, we're excited, in my magazine, about writing about multi-touch computing and about nanotechnology and so on. But you're right, talking about concrete and steel bridges and tunnels and wastewater treatment plants is less fun.
If they buttressed a bridge with iPhones,
yeah,
everyone would be stoked.
Right, you could do that for sure.
It's funny when you talk about 50 and 60 years. I'm thinking about baby boomers who didn't take care of their bodies.
I know, this is a total
metaphor. Down. It's reminding me of the infrastructure.
It's like the midlife crisis of the United States. It's true.
Yeah. Do you? What are some of the biggies that people should be thinking about?
Right. Well, typing list has to be energy. I mean, every year now, I mean, it hasn't happened yet this summer, but it gets really hot in August, and we have blackouts in many parts of the country. And, you know, this is the United States. You wouldn't expect that to be happening here. That's, you know, what you'd expect to be happening in Bangladesh and Baghdad. But that fact that we've kind of gotten used to that is really kind of appalling and very striking. So that's one of the things that I would talk about. And we've, you know, increased the population in the United States by, you know, 100 million people from 200 million to 300 million in the last generation. Well, how much more electricity capacity have we built? You know, very little. So that would definitely be near the top of the list. Obviously, people are talking about things like bridges. One of the striking things for me, which is sort of, you know, really, I think, telling, is a couple of years ago, the American Society of Civil Engineers did a report card on the nation's infrastructure. And this has been in the media, you know, somewhat over the last week or so. And bridges got a C for their poor condition. That was one of the better grades. I mean, dams got a D. You know, wastewater treatment, I think, got a D minus. There were a lot of Ds in there. And, you know, bridges, you drive over and you notice there are lots of other kinds of infrastructure that are really equally dangerous or serious that you don't really see as much. And we need to have, you know, we need to pay more attention to it.
I know that your beat is mechanics of the popular variety, not politics. But do you actually think that there's going to be the political will to do some of this stuff?
I have to, you know, hope springs eternal in the offices of Popular Mechanics. And what we try to do
is that the subtitle of the magazine, Popular Mechanics, where hope springs eternal?
Very, very much. And so what we try to do, I mean, we did some big investigations like hydrogen power last year and ethanol and stuff like that. And what we really try to do is present the real facts and kind of crunch the numbers on things. As far as the political will goes, I mean, things can happen and they you know, do happen. And, you know, so we're hopeful.
I have one more question, though. When I brought home a C or a D, only once did I bring home a D in Spanish, my parents were the ones who said, hey, get back in your room and study a little bit more. If we're getting these report cards with C's and D's, who's telling somebody to go back to the drawing board and work harder and get an A or B?
Well, if I think it's an interesting question. If you have just, you know, kind of a minute for what I think
sure.
is part of what happened. In the 20s, 30s, things like that, yeah. The founders of General Motors and Henry Ford and people like that were clamoring for good infrastructure, bridges and canals that worked and locks and that kind of thing. And it wasn't really a populist thing. That's the way the economy, you know, ran. And now, you know, people are more interested in people like the Bill Gateses of the world. And that's really where the kind of the throwaway to the economy is. There's nothing wrong with Bill Gates, but, you know, Silicon Valley and that kind of infrastructure. So we have a really good internet infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we haven't made the, you know, migration as human beings into the electronic realm. I mean, we still have physical bodies and we still have to move oil around. We still have to move food around and you know, toys from China and stuff has to, you know, move, you know, physically. And so we're not going to get the same kind of push from sort of the economic titans of the country. It really has to be people demanding on a sort of, you know, personal basis that this is a really high priority. And, you know, that report card was talking about, you know, a bill of something like $1.2 trillion to fix the infrastructure over the next 5 years. It's an enormous sum of money, but it's a wealthy country, and we do spend that kind of money on other things. So we can do it.
I would have paid that much to get the F train two mornings ago when I was in the tunnel. Jerry Valenson, deputy editor of Popular Mechanics magazine. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you.
Thursday at 3:06 p.m., an alert flashed across my inbox. Dateline New York, Associated Press, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen more than 300 points. I read it. I deleted it. It went on to lose 87 more points, another valley and a summer of ups and downs. And as I read the papers this morning, I see the Dow has lost more than 700 points over the course of the summer. And I know I should care. I'm not really sure why I should care, which brings me to this week's edition of our regular feature we like to call Make Me Care. Terry Cullen, come on down. You write the Fiscally Fit column for the Wall Street Journal Online. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So in simple terms, why did the Dow drop yesterday?
Well, over the last 5 years, a bunch of lenders have been writing really risky mortgages to people with bad credit and other people who just really couldn't afford their homes. Now a lot of those mortgages are starting to go bad, and lenders and mortgage companies are starting to go out of business because of it. And I think investors on Wall Street are starting to get scared that this is going to become an even bigger, more widespread problem.
All right, so now we know why it dropped. Now we're going to challenge you to make me care why it dropped. You're going to put 60 seconds on the clock. You have 1 minute to explain why I and we in the Bryant Park Project community should give a hoot about the Dow losing 387 points yesterday. And when you hear the clock, you only have 10 seconds left. Okay, Terry, make me care.
Well, the simple answer is that you really shouldn't care. You really shouldn't pay attention to the ups and downs of the stock market day to day. When you're an investor, you want to have the long-term horizon. If you have a retirement account, you probably are investing in mutual funds. Just make sure that you've got a proper mix so that you're not too heavily invested in one area and not invested enough in another. I think the people who really should care about the stock market day to day right now are people who are nearing retirement. If you've got a lot of your retirement savings in stocks right now, you probably should be reassessing that just to make sure that you're not too aggressively in the stock market.
You have 26 seconds left, Terry.
Well, the good news about this whole housing market implosion is if you're in the market for a house right now, housing prices are coming down because of all these foreclosures. That's the good news. The bad news is if you don't have really good credit, you're not going to qualify for those really low rates you're seeing advertised.
Terry, you're amazing. You blew my mind by telling me I shouldn't care during Make Me Care, but at the end, came around, gave us a reason to think about the Dow just a little bit. Terry Cullen from Fiscally Fit from the Wall Street Journal Online, thanks for rising to the challenge.
Did she make you care?
It was a pleasure.
Did she make you care?
She made me care a little bit. I'm sort of interested in this whole subprime mortgage thing. I think that is very, very sketchy.
I wanted to give her a ding
if she made you care. But hey, my mic's on. How awesome is that? Coming up, by the way, we've got lots of good stuff for you, including a discussion of a woman who went into labor during her American Idol audition. Oh, and the story actually gets worse. Also, a guy who snuck a monkey on an airplane. And
that could only be in the Ramble, I think.
That is, in fact, in the Ramble, Allison.
And hey, do you think your kid looks oddly like the hot guy down the hall from you?
Wait, that sounds really, really inappropriate.
Well, get an over-the-counter paternity test. The ins and outs of finding out who's the daddy with the founder of one of the big paternity testing companies.
Also, we're going to talk about this triple murder that happened in Newark last week, and that's been getting a lot of attention. We've got an NPR reporter and Newark resident, Nancy Solomon. She'll be here to talk to us via telephone. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. Coming up, we're going to talk to NPR reporter and Newark resident Nancy Solomon about the latest in this case of those schoolyard murders that happened right in Newark. But right now, first, take a time to look at some stories, not necessarily making headlines, but worthy of the Ramble.
That would be very folksy Ramble if we did that. Very electro guitar. This is a little better. This is a little funkier.
It's good music to describe a man who smuggled a monkey onto an airplane under his hat. That's what I say. He boarded a plane in Lima, Peru, was headed to Fort Lauderdale, and somebody happened to notice that, Mister, you have a marmoset on your head.
I can't get a bottle of Pert Plus onto the damn plane. He's got a monkey.
Didn't bother me at all. If you've got little kids with their snotty noses running up and down the aisles licking seats, a nice little monkey doesn't bother me.
All right, Allison, I have a heartwarming story for you out of the greater St. Louis area. There's a guy named Rick Ankiel, and he was a pitcher. When he was 19 years old, he broke into the majors. He was a phenom. They even let him pitch in the playoffs, and he had a complete meltdown. It was like from a movie. He could not throw the ball in the direction of home plate. He had 5 wild pitches in one inning. It was a record. Okay, so it's this story of a guy who like kind of lost it, had a total meltdown. We don't hear from Rick Ankiel for years. He goes back into the minor leagues. He refashioned himself as an outfielder, learns how to hit again, works his way back up. Last night, he got back into the majors with the St. Louis Cardinals as an outfielder and hit a 3-run home run on his debut night.
That is a fantastic story.
Who says there are no second acts?
Hey, a little bit of baby news we got for you. A New Zealand couple, they named their son Superman because they couldn't get the government to agree to the name they wanted to name him, which was For Real. The number 4 Real, because they said when they saw him first in the sonogram, it was like, dude, it's for real. We're having a kid. The father said he's going to keep going with this thing because he's, quote, not a quitter.
That's a real triumph of the human spirit. Speaking of kids, a Texas woman went into labor while waiting for her American Idol audition. She refused to leave until she had a chance to sing her song. She sang while having contractions and finally agreed to go to the hospital when she was told that she was, in fact, still in contention to make it to the next round. She named the baby Jameel LeBaron Idol McCowan. I'd say if you let someone name a baby Jameel LeBaron Idol, you should be able to name him For Real.
I'm with you. And that wraps up this edition of The Ramble.
You want to be the father?
Yes, sir.
You think David could be the father?
There's a possibility.
When it comes to one-month-old Bryson, Michael, you are not the father.
Yes, the Maury Povich Show, which makes car wreck TV out of the incredibly detailed science of matching genetic material to determine from whom one is descended, otherwise known as the paternity test. In a world where Anna Nicole's millionaire-to-be baby is so cute, 3 people claim to be the proud papa.
I don't think it was 3. I think it was like 8 by the end.
In a world where Academy Award nominee Eddie Murphy this week was finally forced to admit that he'd fathered 4-month-old Angel Iris Murphy Brown, his daughter with Melanie Brown, a.k.a. Scary Spice. And in a week when comedian Chris Rock was made very happy by a paternity test, a court-ordered test proved that a woman who had been running around for years claiming Rock had fathered her child was wrong, but she's actually contesting the whole thing. From Maury guests to Hollywood elite, how do people living on both ends of the economic and social strata find themselves asking the question, who's the daddy? We know how they actually...
Yeah, no, no.
Yeah, that's... that part. We just want to know more about what it all means. Yeah. So Terry Carmichael is joining us, the founder of Gene Tree, a DNA paternity testing facility. Terry, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, there have to be reasons besides all these glammed up celebrity cases for people, average people, to seek out a paternity test. What are the legal reasons?
Oh, there are a number of reasons. And to start off, probably most prominently is the reason to determine child support or child custody issues. And that is probably the most prevalent. And leading on to a peace of mind, of course, as we all know, if you aren't sure if you're the father and you don't know, peace of mind is a very,
it's an important thing.
Yeah, it's an important thing. There's a lot of anxiety behind not knowing the truth, and so there's peace of mind that is really pushing this to be, a service that's offered to the people.
Sure, because if you're married, if you're a woman and you're married, whoever you're married to goes down on the birth certificate as the father, whether or not it's the biological father or not. So can someone actually be forced to take a paternity test?
Yes, you can have a court-ordered paternity test.
Well, how accurate are they?
Paternity tests are very accurate. Today, the most commonly used procedure is referred to as PCR, and it will prove, you know, if the father is excluded from being the biological father, it is 100% conclusive. That means there's no possible way he can be the biological father of that child.
I saw a study, some kind of survey released that found that there was much, much more cuckolding out there than people knew, in that a lot, I mean, maybe not a lot, but more kids are not from the two parents than really people would imagine. And I guess I wonder, people were just going around probably raising kids that may or may not have been theirs for, you know, generations and not knowing it. Now that we have this science, is this really good to know this stuff, or is this just making things worse for people?
Well, I think it helps out a lot. Because, again, it goes back to anxiety. There's a lot of anxiety, and once the test is done and the results are released, people feel more comfortable. It doesn't really matter if the results exclude the father or include the father. In most cases, everybody feels more comfortable that the answer is out there. And in the cases that we run at the lab and just about most commonly in all laboratories, we see about 80% of the cases come out as inclusions, which means the father is the biological father in a paternity test, and only about 20% of the cases are currently exclusions.
And I understand there are some implications, even dealing with one of the hot-button issues right now in the political season, in terms of immigration?
Immigration is definitely a reason to have a paternity test. The INS requires in many cases to prove a biological relationship between the U.S. citizen and non-U.S. citizen that is looking to, immigrate to the United States, before they move forward with the process.
Is there any way to game a paternity test to make sure to slide someone else's DNA in there?
Well, we have seen things like, people making their own results. And from a Word document, coming up with a laboratory name, there's been cases in the news where a medical doctor at one time put a tube of blood into his arm, and when they were taking the blood from him, they would take it from the blood of somebody else that was in the tube of his arm. Some people will go to great lengths to try and get around the responsibilities involved with being a biological father, I guess.
One more question for you, yes or no. Over-the-counter paternity tests, are they reliable?
Yes, I think they are very reliable. It's important that the labs that are doing them are AABB accredited, which is the most important accreditation out there. And I feel that in many cases they are, but there are some laboratories out there you may be uncomfortable with.
Terry Carmichael is the founder of GeneTree, a DNA paternity testing facility. Thanks, Terry.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
Coming up, you're going to hear my interview with Craig Finn and Tad Kubler. They're from the band The Hold Steady. We got to talk to them backstage last night before they played a big free show in Brooklyn. First of all, let's get you caught up on some of the news we're following at this hour. There's literally no word from trapped miners in Utah. Early this morning, they lowered a microphone down to try to listen in and see if, in fact, these miners were still alive. Officials say nothing should be read into the silence, so they remain hopeful that they will find the miners alive.
Authorities searched around 6 planes at Charlotte Douglas International Airport on Friday after a man bypassed security screening. Officials shut down a concourse but did not immediately find the fella. 10 planes left the airport before they could start the search, however. When those planes land, passengers will have to go through a reverse screening, basically another security check.
And Lance Armstrong's former cycling team is calling it quits. The Discovery Channel pulled its sponsorship of the team. The owners, Tailwind Sports, couldn't find another sponsor, so they'll cease operations at the end of this season. Team manager Johan Brunel told Belgian television that the drug scandals in the sport have made it so that nobody wants to be involved with it.
Well, those are some of the stories that we're keeping our eye on this morning on the Bryant Park Project.
I don't think words can describe the level of emotion I feel about this individual and all the individuals involved and what they've done to these families and what I feel as mayor of a city, what they've done to harm the community fabric here, the spirit of our community, as well as our reputation.
That's New York. That's Newark, New Jersey Mayor Cory Booker yesterday at a press conference talking about the arrest of two suspects in an execution-style triple murder that went down at a schoolyard last Saturday night. Yesterday was a really crazy day. During a different press conference, Mayor Booker actually got a call that the main suspect was going to surrender but would only do it if he could surrender directly to Cory Booker, the mayor, who's not, you know, a police officer or anything. Nancy Solomon has been covering the story for NPR this week. She's here to bring us up to speed. Nancy, you actually live a few blocks away from where this happened in Newark.
I do. I live in the town of South Orange, but I'm literally about 7 or 8 blocks away from the elementary school where the shooting took place.
Why do you think that this has become such a big national news story?
Well, I think there are a few reasons. I think there's the there but for the grace of God go I factor. You know, people have a visceral response to crimes that could have happened to them. And the story also taps into the innocent victim narrative for young people trying to rise above their circumstances with so much promise, killed senselessly and brutally. So I think the media is always attracted to stories like that, and they're attracted to stories that break the norm. So, you know, on average, a person gets murdered in Newark about once every 3 or 4 days, but most of those people are involved in criminal activity or they're known by the person who kills them. So this kind of random violence is still pretty rare in Newark as it is everywhere in the country.
Can you just tell us a little bit about the victims?
It's really sad when anyone is murdered, but these 4 young people, their stories are really heart-wrenching because they were tight friends since elementary school. They ranged in age from 18 to 20. 2 were already attending Delaware State, and 2 were about to join them in the fall. They had played in their high school band. They went to a high school not too far from where the shooting took place that's in a very distressed neighborhood in Newark and, you know, is very under-resourced. And, you know, by all accounts, they were able to rise up, do very well, go on to college. One was a junior preacher. He volunteered in the community. One was a runway model sometimes, very handsome young man. So it's really, their stories have really captured, I think, the people of Newark and around the country.
You mentioned 4 victims, although because one of the people who was shot actually survived somewhat miraculously, and then I guess she picked out of a lineup a suspect who, this was the big news this morning, is that the police have in custody these 2 suspects. Who are these guys?
Well, the first one they arrested is a 15-year-old who they're not identifying. He lived in with his family near the elementary school. He seems to have some loose connection to the second fellow that they arrested, an adult, a 29-year-old whose name is Jose Carranzo. He's originally from Peru. There's kind of some interesting stories going on. The Star Ledger had a piece about Carranzo this morning that I thought was just is very confusing because on the one hand, his neighbors and his family say that he's a hardworking man. He has a job. He helps out in the neighborhood. And then you hear from the police that he's got this long criminal record, that some of it's pretty nasty. I mean, you know, sexual molestation of very young girls is some of the things he's been charged with. And in one case convicted of. So there are these 2 very conflicting stories about this guy, but, you know, he did turn himself in, and you have to kind of wonder if he is guilty, why he wouldn't have tried to make a run for it.
That's something we were talking about just before the show. If he, in fact, did this, you could presume he's going to go to jail forever and ever. And so it seems like he would want to delay that forever and ever's beginning as long as possible. It's an odd thing.
Yeah, you know, he's originally from Peru. If it were me, I'd be on my way to Machu Picchu about now. I mean, yeah. You know, maybe I don't understand how hard it is to get back and to cross borders when you're being a wanted suspect, but there's something amiss here. There really is.
Well, were you at this press conference yesterday where the mayor gets a call, like, on his cell phone, and it's from the lawyer of this guy saying he's going to surrender, but he wants to do it to you directly?
Yeah, I was. It's a little different than that, but the call came in to his chief of staff.
Okay.
And so this fellow, the aide to the mayor, in the midst of this press conference, which was pretty extraordinary in itself by Newark standards, because it was just there was just a massive number of press people there, and Booker had assembled behind him on the podium a pretty extraordinary group of leading politicians, the superintendent of schools, all the top police guys. And so, you know, this was like this big unity moment. He was showing the whole city was behind him to, you know, really move on this. And so you have this kind of major thing going on, and his aide comes and whispers in his ear, and I don't think any of us knew at the time, and then the mics didn't pick it up. But quickly, soon after that, he ends the press conference, and he says in this really intense way, "All the dignitaries, come with me," which seemed a little strange, but we didn't know what was going on. As it turns out, a lawyer that he knows personally is on the phone. The lawyer has the suspect with him in his car, and it says he wants to come in, but only to the mayor. And where should they meet?
Well, one of the things about Cory Booker, which I don't know if a lot of people know, when he ran for mayor before with Sharp James as the mayor of Newark, and he's this guy who went to Stanford and all fancy schools, and then he went and he actually lived in Newark and became sort of a community activist. And I'm wondering if that plays into this at all, Nancy, that people kind of trust Cory Booker because they know he walks the walk and talks the talk.
I think it's possible. I mean, certainly he's a dazzling politician.
He's in his late 30s. He's a young guy, too.
He's charismatic. He's handsome. He's articulate. You know, he's a smart guy. And I think and he's done a masterful job in this crisis dealing with the media and putting a very strong face forward in this. So, yes, I think it's really interesting that this guy would only want to go to him. I don't know quite what it says about, you know, fears that people might have about the police. But, you know, Booker also isn't entirely accepted by longtime Newarkers. They see him as an interloper. But, you know, in this situation, I think he's really established himself.
NPR reporter and Newark resident Nancy Solomon. Nancy, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Coming up, we're going to be joined by Rob Walker. You know the name because he writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine. He's going to help us understand the evolving world of the cadult. We'll also talk about some serious stuff, the week in Iraq.
And some not so serious stuff, but, you know, musical stuff anyway. Craig Finn and Tad Kubler from the Hold Steady, Brooklyn's finest, are going to be. We'll have an interview I did with them last night.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Bryant Park Project, courtesy of NPR News. The Week in Iraq is a regular feature on the BPP, and as we try to get our heads around all that happened in the past 7 days, it appears the U.S. military took center stage this week in Iraq.
Music.
The number of U.S. troops in Iraq has reached its peak since the invasion. There are over 160,000 in the country. There are over 190,000 missing weapons in or around Iraq, including thousands of AK-47s. The Government Accountability Office says about a third of the weapons the U.S. supplied to Iraqi security in the past 3 years, they just can't be found. This BBC report tries to explain why.
Investigators working for the U.S. Government Accountability Office found there was a need to equip the forces rapidly for combat, and the people giving out the guns were too short-staffed to keep a record. But many of these weapons must have found their way into the hands of insurgents.
On the subject of arms, last month a type of bomb supplied by Iran killed more troops than ever before. There were 99 attacks using what are called explosively formed projectiles, or EFPs. Lieutenant General Odinero, told CNN what the U.S. is doing about the problem.
First of all, we are very clearly going after the Shia extremist cells that are operating in Baghdad. We continue to go after these EFP networks in Baghdad and all over the country.
The U.S. military says 32 militants were targeted and killed in the Shia area of Sadr City in Baghdad, but local officials say civilians are among the dead. All of this against the backdrop of a huge religious pilgrimage. NPR's Corey Flintoff paints the picture.
It's a festival atmosphere despite or possibly because of the presence of heavily armed soldiers and police at every street corner. Pilgrims have been the targets of sectarian attacks every year, killed by car bombs, mortars, and sniper fire.
That's Corey Flintoff reporting from Baghdad. Thousands are expected to attend. Anthony Shadid has served as the Baghdad bureau chief for the Washington Post. He joins us now from Lebanon. And Anthony, as we mentioned, the surge is at its peak right now. Let's back up a little bit and remind people, what prompted the president to call for this surge, and what was the main goal originally?
You know, I thought it was remarkable that President Bush was actually pretty forthright about why the surge was necessary. When he was speaking with the British Prime Minister recently, he said that he saw that things were not going well in Iraq, that the American project, or however you would define it, was at risk. And he made the decision to send more troops, to increase the number of troops to the highest levels, you know, perhaps since the invasion itself. I think over the next, you know, what we're going to see over the next, the coming weeks and through September especially is going to be very decisive, I think, in how events in Iraq unfold over the next year. I mean, I think we are at a turning point. And I think, as you noted, that the troop levels are where they're at right now is something very worth noting.
Let's talk about that report of missing weapons. Besides being just a little more than mind-boggling that 190,000 weapons can go missing, it makes me wonder about the procedures in Iraq. Why has it been so chaotic that arms are handed out so freely, and why would the military have enough confidence in the new Iraqi military to just turn over weapons like this?
You know, I wonder if they do have that much confidence, though, in the new Iraqi military. I tell you, one thing that's always struck me, and I think this struck me even in those first weeks after the fall of Saddam, was just how accessible weapons were in Iraq. There were, you know, vast arms depots that were left by the former Iraqi government that, you know, even somebody in a taxi could basically access, enter, pick up what they wanted. Arms has never really been an issue, or lack of arms has never been an issue for the insurgency. I mean, when we talk about the police force, when we talk about the Iraqi military, you know, almost from the very beginning of post-Saddam Iraq, the idea of setting up an Iraqi police force, setting up some kind of arms of or instruments of authority, you know, the way you set them up is to provide them weapons. And those weapons have always been so, you know, very, very easy to get hold of. And I think, you know, actually hearing this number that many have been unaccounted for doesn't surprise me. We're looking at something that was kind of haphazard until perhaps recently, this idea of setting up security forces. And it's not, I think this is still an area that, you know, often the military will be very forthright that this is not, you know, this isn't where they expect it to be.
Now, what did you think when you heard the U.S. military had gone after militants in Sadr City?
You know, Sadr City has always been a decisive, it's always been an incredibly important, you know, piece of the puzzle in Iraq, mainly because it's under the, you know, under the authority of Muqtada Sadr, who is at this point arguably one of the, you know, the most important politician in Iraq, or figure in Iraq, we should say, and is going to have an incredible amount of relevance once withdrawal starts getting underway. He's going to be a very, I think, in the coming years we're going to hear more and more about Muqtada Sadr, either as a person who enters into coalitions or who decides the coalitions himself. I think that's the backdrop you want to see this this raid on Masada City. And because, I mean, the idea, you know, Masada does have a following. That following is very loyal to him. Attacks on his stronghold in Sadr City have to run the risk of alienating his followers even to a greater degree than they already have, you know, against the Americans. So I think that's where the importance becomes, is what does this do to both Sadr's standing and also the kind of perspective of his followers.
After it was revealed that Iran is supplying these EFPs, the ones that killed more troops in July than ever before, the military that told CNN they thought that Iran was trying to make a hole so that the report that comes out in September is a poor report and therefore creates a vacuum and Iran can slip right in there and get a little more of a power base. What do you think about that argument from the military?
You know, there's no question that Iran has a national interest in Iraq. Obviously, you know, Iraq is on the border with Iran. It's going to have a degree of interference or involvement or however we want to describe it. It's almost indisputable. What exactly Iranian intentions are, though, I think has been confusing almost since the start. I mean, even back in 2003, when it was easier to report in Iraq, you go down to a city like Basra. Basra is almost on the Iranian border. And even trying to figure out what the Iranians were exactly intending to do there was confusing. And I think there may be several other agendas going on at the same time. There may be an agenda to create more unrest or to make the country more difficult to govern. There may be an agenda of trying to, you know, further the influence and further the power of the Shiite-led government. But I think this question of what the Iranian intentions specifically are is something that hasn't been answered yet. And it may not become apparent until we see an American military withdrawal, when we see, you know, the Americans decreasing their presence or decreasing their influence to some degree. I think we might see in plainer terms what the Iranians exactly want from Iraq over the long term.
Anthony Shadid was the Baghdad bureau chief for The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us and taking the time out. Be safe in Lebanon.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
Now here's Matt Martinez with the headlines that we're following at this hour.
Good morning. Wall Street keeps on tumbling down. The Dow dropped 133 points in the opening minutes of trading this morning. The space shuttle Endeavour is about to dock with the International Space Station, but Houston, there may be a problem. A piece of foam fell off the ship during liftoff. They're going to check it out, see if it's a problem. A microphone lowered into the mine where six miners are trapped returned only silence this morning. Rescuers are still hopeful they'll find the miners alive. Word this morning that Virginia Tech shooter Sung-Wi Cho might have made a practice run 2 days before the massacre, even chaining doors to the building where he killed 30 people. And the Discovery Channel put the brakes on sponsorship of the American cycling team. The team can't find another sponsor, so they're calling it quits. They're going to disband at the end of the year. I'm Matt Martinez. The news is always online at npr.org. Back to you, Luke and Allison.
It's the only reason that people even pay attention to cycling right now seems to be to find out who's getting kicked out for doping. I mean, seriously, and then, can you imagine, an NFL team couldn't find the money to get uniforms or whatever because of the, you know, the scandals were so much? I mean, that's a bad sign for cycling.
Pack it up.
Scandal.
Yeah.
You are listening to the sweet, sweet sounds of The Hold Steady. They're a Brooklyn band I interviewed last night before they played a free concert in Prospect Park. You're going to hear that interview in a minute. First, though, take a listen.
There are nights when I think that South Paradise was right. Boys and girls in America, they're such a sad time together. Sucking off each other at the demonstrations, making sure they make us straight. Crushing one another with colossal expectations, depending on discipline, sleep and wait. She was a really cool kisser, and she wasn't all that strict of a Christian.
This is Stuck Between Stations off of the Hold Steady's latest record, which is called Boys and Girls in America. Probably, aside from Prince, the Hold Steady has got to be the most well-known band coming out of Minneapolis right now, which is, I guess, not saying that they're that famous, but they're certainly critical darlings. All the people who know from music really like this band, the Hold Steady. I think it's because lead singer Craig Finn has this kind of weird shout rap singing style. Anyway, I got to talk to them backstage before their show. Now, we had a little recording issue, so the audio is not what it could be, but it's still pretty cool. Here, take a listen.
Could you kind of just describe your singing style a little bit? I had my 13-year-old daughter, we were listening to your records today, so I was saying, I'm going to talk to these guys, and she goes, I really like it, the parts where he sings, but he's not doing a lot of singing.
Right.
How would you describe
well,
it?
Well, I think, you know, it's part of it was just a limited voice, but I think what I try to do is, it's kind of almost a conversational thing where I talk and kind of amplify my own voice, and, you know, and I also try to write things in a way that's natural for me to say it, and there's singers, you know, that obviously I'm not blessed with a traditionally great voice, but so one of the things that I always makes me cringe the most in other singers is when people sing in a voice that's not theirs. Like, they almost imitate what they would want their voice to sound like, and that to me is like I have to shut it off. So what it is basically, you know, my singing is my voice amplified, or my talking voice really amplified.
Yeah, there's like a whole kind of. It's like people get obsessed with Lord of the Rings, and they start trying. Like people get obsessed with Lift or Pull Over lyrics, yeah, and Hold Steady lyrics, and when in songs when things happen to people, it's like people get freaked out on Pitchfork Media about what happened to this place or this person. Does it surprise you that people are that into it?
Well, it doesn't. Nothing surprises me anymore. But yeah, there is some. I mean, people are really into it. People like. Do I just have one question? You know, and it's like, I don't know the answer to the question. It's just a song. You know, these aren't real people that exist in a different universe. They're just, you know, creations. But I think that one of the things is I try to write lyrics that are, when I was listening to rock and roll as a kid, it was like this whole other world. It was, you know, certainly something that was not happening in my house anytime in Minnesota. It was something out there, and I wanted to know more about it. And I think that's maybe how I write lyrics, just because there is this idea that you can uncover something or something, this world out there that you know nothing about.
And in terms of the music, I think that people have said it sounds like there's a certain element of classic rock to it.
Sure.
That doesn't sound like a diss.
No, not at all. I think, like Craig has said, like, you know, classic with a small C, or I just say it's really just traditional rock music.
Timeless, yeah. It's really timeless. I mean, if you aren't caught up in any particular trend of this exact moment, then when that trend passes, they can't take it away from you. You know, it just always is. You know, I know before we started this band, I was kind of going, you know, I have a huge record collection, and I'd come home every night, and I'd be like, what do I want to hear? And I'd be like, well, to tell you the truth, nothing sounds better than when I put on the Rolling Stones.
Jack Kerouac is a guy who is cited, and it's clearly kind of an influence for you.
Yeah.
And yeah, I've read reviews where people are comparing, I think it's the whatever anniversary of On the Road is coming up this year, I think, and people are writing about that and have written about that in the same way that they've written about stuff that you guys have done. Is that kind of mind-blowing? Is it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think with Kerouac is so interesting to me because, you know, I think his portrayal in the years that have followed him being published is that he's a decadent beatnik, you know, maybe that he's on Ginsberg, you know, when really Kerouac was a college football star. He was a very traditional guy. He liked sports, baseball. You know, I sort of think that's something that I really love about him, and that, you know, I feel like I'm the same way. I mean, I like playing a rock and roll band, but I like drinking beer and eating wings with my friends, watch baseball, high fives, things like that. And it's
the finer things.
Yeah.
Right.
Those are the things that I
like. You high five with your pinky out there. Keep it classy.
So I think it's very interesting, you know, in the way he, you know, the way sort of his legacy has changed. But when you really start to investigate, it's like, this guy was like, you know, really, really strict, really normal, and was just kind of interested in traveling and recording his, you know, his experiences.
That was Luke Burbank's interview with the Hold Steady.
Part of it, yeah.
Where did you do that in a tin can? What's up with the...
Yeah, we actually, you know, this is NPR after all. No, what happened was we had a little problem with the audio recording setup. We didn't have one, but we had a video camera.
Okay.
And Wynn Rosenfeld, our able video producer, taped it. And actually, it's a really cool video interview. That audio didn't do it justice, but if you're a fan of the Hold Steady, or even if you're not... you got to go to the website, the Bryant Park blog, which is, you can get it through npr.org, and watch this video because it has cool stuff from the concert, and also it has the interview, and again, it makes a lot more sense when you're watching it.
Look forward to it.
All right.
A little later on. We've learned something interesting in the last week here at the BBP. Well, maybe not interesting. Maybe just telling. Do you know they make Heelys for grown men, Luke? Do you know those shoes with the heels in the back? You see kids zipping around the sidewalk?
If I knew that, I would be wearing them right now, Stuart.
Well, apparently adults can strap on a pair. And before you think who would do that, Luke, think about this. You know you've seen this person, a 30-year-old, 30-something, 40-something, on a Razor scooter going down the street, or some guy at your office who has toys on his desk, and they don't really belong to his kid. Or somebody wearing sneakers that cost about 150 clams.
Easy.
That means you've encountered a kadult. They are people who are chronologically adults, but otherwise still hanging around in Kidville.
I won't grow up.
I won't grow up.
I don't want to wear a tie.
I don't want to wear a tie.
And a serious expression.
And a serious expression.
In the middle of July.
In the middle of July.
Or August or September or any other month. To help us dissect the kadult, we're joined by Rob Walker. He writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine. And Rob, where do you think the effects of kadult culture are felt the most?
Wow. Well, where aren't they felt the most these days? But, you know, you're starting with a good point by mentioning something mentioning things that people wear, because that's kind of the easiest way you can for an adult to sort of try to disguise themselves, fooling no one but themselves, disguise themselves.
I really feel like this segment is a personal assault on me, but we can get to that later.
Simmer down there, Paco. I got the mic. Anyhow, so in terms of are we sure this just isn't some giant bludgeon of a marketing tool?
Well, here's what I think. I think that, you know, marketers have always been really interested in youth, and media has always been interested in youth for obvious reasons, which is that they do, you know, a lot of trends and weird, interesting things happen among young people, and that goes back to the 20s, and that's, you know, that's no surprise, and that makes sense. I think, though, that what's happened more recently is that this idea of sort of seeming young, it's not just a marketing invention. I actually think it's kind of almost a workplace invention in some ways, and particularly in the kind of 90s moment when the Internet came along and there started to be this sort of fault line in a lot of businesses as to who got it and who didn't, and it seemed like the young people got it. And if you didn't get it, not only were you kind of like a fuddy-duddy, but it was like you were going to lose your job.
Lots of places where they had like foosball tables and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So then it became, you know, I remember this from a company I was working at the time. There was this sort of moment when all of the sort of middle-aged guys, I was in my 20s, and the sort of middle-aged guys all of a sudden were dressing. I had to wear a necktie because I didn't have, you know, I was a powerless drone. And now all of a sudden the big shots were showing up to work in, like, you know, jeans and a turtleneck because they'd all been put in charge of Internet projects. And somehow, I guess the thinking was they would get the future better if they looked younger. That seemed to be the theory that they were operating on.
I think once upon a time they used to call this the Peter Pan syndrome. I mean, is this about an emotional issue of not wanting to move on from a heyday in your life, or is it just a really good case of marketing to people's insecurities about getting old?
Well, I think there's definitely some natural psychological stuff that goes on there. No one really sits around thinking about, you know, their own mortality and things like that. You know, we're all nostalgic and we all want to feel younger than we are. But yeah, you know, that leaves us a little bit vulnerable to marketers who can say, like, well, hey, you'll be younger than you are if only you'll, kind of get this whatever, if drink this kind of beer or the sneaker thing that you mentioned is a great example of something that it just became not only acceptable, but it's sort of like, you know, why aren't you wearing $200 sneakers? Don't you get it? That's what's going on now. You know, that's the new cool thing for grown-ups.
There was this book that was just hanging around in the lobby of NPR, and it was written by a very conservative columnist called We Need to Grow Up in This Country, and she's a little bit of a crank about it, saying, yeah, you know, moms who mosh and adult Britneys are a really huge problem in civilization. But there's a line, the last line in her book says, a civilization that dodges maturity will never live to a ripe old age. What do you think about that?
That's pretty tough. I think, you know, maybe that's true. But I think that it's not quite – you mentioned the Peter Pan thing, and, like, this sounds sort of similar. And I think that there's something going on that's like kind of wanting it all, because it's not like it's not like people don't want to have some of the trappings of adulthood. They want to have kids, and they want to have, I mean, a lot of these people you're talking about, they are, you know, parents, and they certainly want the grown-up toys as well. They want, you know, the SUV and all that kind of stuff, but they don't want to let go of the things you're supposed, you know, it used to be sort of a process, and you would, at a certain point, you say, well, now it's time to put aside childish things. And we're sort of in a moment where, well, why? Maybe I can have, maybe I can have it all. And
if there's a kidult ground zero, it's where I live, Park Slope, Brooklyn,
or Williamsburg. The two of those.
Or Williamsburg. The Williamsburg is even, I think, a little youngish. Park Slope is all dads with appropriately mussed hair and jeans and awesome sneakers, pushing their awesomely cute kids who are named, you know, Linus or Finn. And their wives who still do Bikram yoga every day, but they still listen to the Hold Steady. You know, it's like,
yeah.
I was hanging out with like 1,000
of
them
those
last
people.
Night.
Well, what's fascinating about that is that it shows where the peer pressure comes from, because it's not as if actual 20-year-olds are sitting around saying, "Gosh, I wonder why people in their 40s don't act more like us." Like, that has nothing to do with it. They don't, you know, they don't want you to friend them on Facebook or whatever.
Right.
It comes completely from the peers. It's like one 40-something guy saying to another one, like, "Hey, did you get that hoodie in the new colorway or whatever?" You know. And, And have you figured out Facebook yet? Like, you know.
Rob Walker, thanks for walking us through the land of the kidult.
Thanks, kids.
I'm gonna go.
How are you feeling, Luke, right now?
I guess I'm gonna go straight out to, you know, to the Dockers store and buy some pleated Dockers.
Brooks brother, block away, buddy.
Yeah, awesome. This
nice
has been the Bryant Park Project.
He's wearing white sneakers.
I'm. You know what? Just because you guys don't appreciate how awesomely fashionable I am. Thank you very much to the hard work of Dan Pashman and MJ Davis and Wynn Rosenfeld. And I think it would be Manoli Weatherall on the buttons. Matt Martinez, the newscaster. I'm Luke Burbank.
Thank you, Luke Burbank. I'm Allison Stewart. And this is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.